When I was a kid, there was an ad that was on TV all the time, and it went like this. What would you do for a? Some of you know it was a Klondike bar. I didn't know if they made Klondike bars anymore. I had to look it up. They do. They're still around somewhere. I haven't seen one in a while. But somehow, that advertisement means if somebody says those words, I can finish the sentence, and a bunch of you can too. Some of you didn't know you're allowed to talk in church. You knew the answer. You just were surprised that I actually wanted you to respond. But it's a great question. I love this question because when they ask us, what would you do for a Klondike bar? Rather than telling you what you need to do, they ask, and you start selling yourself. You start figuring out, what would I do for a Klondike bar? I'm kind of hungry right now. I'm thinking about it. Rather than asking you, you start figuring out, well, I would, you know, do all kinds of goofy things. Because questions are powerful. And when you ask someone a question, you don't have to tell them what to do. What would I do? Maybe I'd wear a funny hat to get an ice cream bar. Maybe I'd tell a bad joke. In fact, as a dad, I would do that anyway. Maybe I would dance like a chicken. I don't know what I'd do for a Klondike bar. Do you know what you actually have to do? It's pay $2 or something like that. That's the real thing that you would have to do to eat an ice cream bar. But they got everyone in America to think about it together, to ask that question, what would I do to get that? This series called Questions from Jesus is just a reminder that questions are powerful. And for the next few weeks, we're going to look at the times that Jesus asked questions. We want to see, how did Jesus use the questions that he asked to connect people to God? How did he help them wonder? How would they participate in all that God was doing or see the world more clearly through the questions that they asked? Last week, we started with a question that Jesus asked Thomas. This question of, have you seen, have you believed because you have seen? But today, we get a doozy. It says Jesus called the crowd with his disciples. He gets all the disciples and all the followers together, and he asks them, what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? I left some of it out, by the way. We'll come back to it, I promise. But here, he puts a question to the crowd that all of us face. I think all of us wonder this, something similar to this. What would it take for you to give up who you are? What would it take for you to change who you are? This Greek word that gets translated life here is zoe, which means life, but it also means soul, and it also means self. What would you, like this idea of everything that encompasses who I am, what does it profit me to gain the whole world and yet to give up myself, to give up my life, to give up my soul? It's easy for me to hear this question and thinking about the cost. Would a new house do it? How about a powerful new job? That car you always dreamed of? I'm going to tell you, because I'm a little bit golf crazy, Sunday Masters tickets today would be very tempting for just a moment, I promise, just to be able to go walk the grounds. I think many of us can probably think about what would be tempting. That's why when you look for the quotes that people know about Jesus, this is one of the ones that's right at the top of this list. This question that we ask is sort of, it's in our public consciousness. It's something we think about all the time. And why? Because once you lose yourself, you can't get it back. Once you lose yourself, you can't get it back. Versions of this show up all over, whether it's the Klondike commercial. What would you do for your Klondike bar? Or maybe you're like me, you grew up watching Homer Simpson. Homer Simpson at one point in time sells his soul for a donut, right? Maybe you've seen some version of that. There's all kinds of versions of this where they're like, oh, I'm so hungry. I just want that right now. Or maybe it's from our own faith history. There's even a story in the Old Testament that correlates to this. In Genesis, Abraham, the sort of father of the Israel nation, has a son, Isaac, and Isaac has two sons, Jacob and Esau. And they're twins, twin brothers. Esau is older, and he's dad's favorite. He's the tough one. They describe him as the hairy one. He's the hunter. He's sort of the rough and tumble guy who goes out and does all the things with his dad. Jacob is the younger one. And he's always looking for his dad's love and affection, but he's mom's favorite. He likes to stay home. He likes to participate in what's going on inside the household and be part of her world. And their whole life is a struggle. But when Isaac is old and cannot see, as Isaac is getting age, he cannot see, we read in the story that Jacob and his mother Rebekah hatch a plan. Here's what it says. Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. And when Esau went to the field to hunt for game for his father, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, I heard your father say this to your brother Esau. Bring me game, and I will prepare and prepare for me savory food, food to eat, that I may bless you before the Lord before I die. Now therefore, my son, obey my word which I commanded you. They see this opportunity here. And in ancient Israel, this blessing was critical. It was not unlike a will, essentially, at this time. It would decide how the property and how the authority of the family would get distributed. All children got a portion of their father's property when they died, all the sons. But they would split it this way, that the oldest would get a double portion, two parts to every other person's part. And the reason for that was they wanted to keep the household together enough. If you had 7 or 8 sons, you could get that property split so far that nobody really has anything. And so the oldest son got double so that they would keep the family together. In addition to that, the one who was blessed, the oldest usually, was considered to be the favored one by God, the one who would carry on the family legacy. And so getting the father's blessing for Jacob the younger, they're twins, so he's minutes younger, but for Jacob the younger, it was tempting to say the least. How could I trick my dad into getting the blessing? Rebecca and her son devise a plan. Rebecca, Isaac's wife, will make the food. He'll prepare it the best way that Isaac loves it. And then Jacob will bring it in. And because Isaac is both pretty blind at this time in his aged life and pretty hard of hearing at this time, Jacob points out that there's only one way that they're going to know which son it is. And that Isaac is going to use his sense of touch in order to figure this out. Remember, we said Esau's the hairy one. So hairy, in fact, that they figure the way to trick dad is to put a sheepskin on Jacob's arms so that it feels like, I'm like, that's a lot. Just so you know, right now, like, that's pretty intense. And mom says, just do that, and he will have no idea what's happening. And as the plan comes to fruition, the conversation turns to this question. What am I doing? Jacob is asking. Should I even be doing this? This seems so dishonest. And in response, his mother says to him, let your curse be on me, my son, and obey only my word, and go and get them for me. Rebecca tells her son, for whatever is going to happen, I'll take the punishment. I'll do this. I'll shoulder all the weight if this goes wrong. Have you ever been in a position where somebody says that? They're asking you to do something that seems not real bright, and they're like, I've got this. I'll take care of these things. Don't worry about it. This will be my fault. It won't be your fault. It'll be fine. You see, if you're uncomfortable with this, and you think it's the wrong thing to do, and you hear somebody say, it's on me, you kind of trust them at that point. But if you've ever done that, you know it never works. The consequences are on everybody. It makes a big mess, and there's all kinds of problems. And as this story continues, it says that after this happens, Rebecca and Isaac are mad at each other. And Esau figures out what Jacob has done, and he's so angry. He takes some of his friends, and he goes and he tries to kill his brother Jacob. You see, the punishment is not on it. It breaks, this decision breaks the whole family apart, and everything falls apart. Jacob is forced to take what he has, run away, and hide from his brother who's trying to hunt him down. The plan they hatch to get something destroys the family. And all just so Jacob could get what he wanted. He may have gained the world, but he lost the life he knew, the family he loved, and the home he had. I always wonder what would have happened if Jesus had asked him this question. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world but lose his life? It's a good, good question. So what do we do? Well, how we respond to this comes from the statement that Jesus made right before he asks the question. What does he say? He says, if you're going to understand what it means to follow, he says, if any wish to come after me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. These are the choices. You get two options. Either you're going to go ahead and take up your cross, which doesn't sound fun, or you're going to lose yourself. I'm like, Jesus, this feels like a catch-22 at this particular moment. I don't quite know what to do with this. This seems extreme. But if you look back at that sentence, can you put that last verse up for me for just a second? If you look back at that sentence, I don't think cross is the word that's the most powerful. I think it's the word that gets translated deny, and it's this word in the Greek. It's aparneomai. I'm going to do my best to pronounce it. I'm going to assume none of you speak Greek either, so I'm going to survive this one if I get it wrong. But I've been thinking about this word a lot because it has three definitions: to deny, to disown, or to disregard. And I've thought about that a lot this week because denying myself is a fascinating statement. It's about what I should give up. It's what we did during Lent. Give up something in your life. I can deny myself alcohol or fast food or screen time to become more holy if that's what I want to do. I can come up with things that I shouldn't do and make a list to deny myself. But when Jesus just looks at the crowd and says, deny yourselves, I think it's a little amorphous. Like, what exactly am I supposed to deny myself of? But when you clarify this word, it can get clearer. I love the second one, to disown yourself. Think about that in two sections. Dis, meaning to get rid of, and own, which means to control myself. I'm going to disown who I am. If you disown yourself, what you're doing is you're giving the ownership of yourself to someone else. Jacob desperately wants his dad's blessing. Then he'll have the money, the land, and the power to control his own life. Why is it so tempting for him to trade his life in order to get this thing? Because he feels like it gives him ownership over himself. It's self-control, and in trying to take control of himself, he loses his relationship with his brother, his father, he loses his safety, and he loses his family. When we try to own, we're destructive. When we try to be the ones who control, we tend to make a bigger mess than what was started. I think this is Jesus' point. Not that you're going to need a cross, but that you're going to need to disregard yourself. You're going to need to disown yourself in a way that gives ownership to somebody else. But here comes the big question: who do we give ownership to? Who will be the owner? This is where Jesus gets interesting. He says, disown yourselves, take up your cross, and follow me. Because he knew what was coming. We told the Easter story last week, but Jesus is telling this story about five chapters ahead of his crucifixion in the Gospel of Mark. He knows what's coming. Did the crowd know about the cross yet? Absolutely not, but he did. And Jesus knew without a shadow of a doubt what it was going to mean for him to give up ownership of himself to something or someone else. And if he's going to give ownership of his life and his soul to the only one who is worthy, he was going to have to be obedient to what that owner was telling him to do, his heavenly Father, who would ask him to go to a literal cross. For us, the odds that we will have to take up a cross are not large. It's pretty unlikely, just because I can't think of anybody anywhere in the world who is doing anything as barbaric as what the Romans were doing in the first century. But But when Jesus says this, he says, I will show you what giving authority over to the one who can be your faithful and loving owner can be, to God himself. He says, I will obey my Father because I will disown myself in favor of letting God be the true authority in my life. And in self-denial, in self-disregard, and in self-disowning, we are invited to do the same thing. We deny our own needs so we can let God be the authority in our life. And when God is the authority, what we are to deny ourselves of becomes clearer and clearer. Because Jesus says, if you follow after me, things will come along that will be in conflict with that. Things will come along that won't make sense in following me, and you can set those aside. To follow after Jesus is to find communion with God and to let God be the authority in our world. It is a blessing and an opportunity to participate in this incredible life, walking alongside the one who died and rose and is reigning on earth today. We started with a silly question: what would you do for a Klondike bar? But the real question is this: what would you do for a life connected to Jesus? What would you do for a life connected to the author and perfecter of our faith, of our life, of who we are? Well, it's simple. We get to disown ourselves so that the God who loved you enough to go to a cross and a grave and to come back for you gets to be the authority in your life. There are so many examples of this. When we love our life and ourselves, and we want to keep it, and we want to say, this is for me. There's some other parts for you, God, but this is for me. When we love our life, we lose it. But when we lose our life in a way that teaches us to lean into who Jesus is, what God gives back is so much more incredible, because we have the presence of God that tells us that this life is not all there is, that there is hope for the future, that the story that you're seeing right now is not all there is. Jacob didn't get it. He didn't realize that his connection to his father and his brother would have been worth so much more than that blessing. And it takes years for them to reconnect and rebuild this relationship so that they can care for one another again. And too often, we look at Jesus and we go, what you have for us just doesn't seem that good. And Jesus keeps offering it again and again and again. He says, if you'll trust me enough to let me have your life, it's going to be better. Not because I have all kinds of amazing financial blessings for you or everything worked out, but because I'm telling you, life with me is full of peace and hope and eternity. That's the good news for today. For that, we give thanks, and all together God's people said, amen.